apologize for the delay, but we had some other meetings we had to get to this morning. President at the table is Co-Chair Parnell, Senator Donnelly, Senator Lehman, Senator Wilkin, Senator Phillips, Senator Kelly, Senator Adams, and myself, Senator Ferguson. We will work our way down the list as posted, first being SB 123, Public Interest Litigants. And I'm going to have Darwin walk us through where we're at on this so I can get all members back. We basically had a finance version in front of us, and then Senator Donnelly gave us a finance CS for our consideration to adopt, and then Senator Parnell gave us a finance CS for us consideration to adopt, and then I put one together, which is kind of a compromise between the two. So this is going to be, I want to start right from the basis again so we can understand where we're going with this. The CS that I did was kind of a, met with some House members, and as we remember, their attempt for this failed on the floor last year, so we're trying to bring this, all the interests together and still protect the public interest litigants. So, Darwin, if you will start us out with where we're at, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Darwin Peterson, Finance Committee Aide to Senator John Torgerson. Certainly, the court treats public interest litigants a little differently than civil litigants. They use a public interest litigant doctrine. And if you will look at the sheet that has just been distributed, it explains the differences in the various committee substitutes that this committee has before it. In version I, committee substitute version I, this version amends Rule 82, and attorney's fees are awarded to and against public interest litigant in the same manner as civil litigants under Rule 82. For a prevailing public interest litigant, they receive 30% of attorney's fees for a case that goes to trial, and 20% of attorney's fees for a case that doesn't go to trial, and that's currently how civil litigants are treated under Rule 82. For a losing public interest litigant, they will be required to pay the prevailing party 30% for a trial case and 20% for a non-trial case. The exceptions to varying attorney's fees, which you'll find on your Rule 82, in your packet says touch and go systems on the top. And that Rule 82 sets out some exceptions that the court can use to vary attorney's fees. And that would apply to public interest litigants under version I. Also, apportionment is an issue that the committee has discussed before. Under version I, apportionment would not be required of attorney's fees.
No, apportionment
issue.
We had a court ruling that dealt with apportionment.
This is Danzerow versus Ulmer case, yes, Mr. Chairman.
And explain that to the committee.
The Danzerow versus Ulmer case ruled that the courts, or set precedent that the courts don't have to apportion by issue, that they can go ahead and they can award a public interest litigant attorney's fees for all of their issues, even if they only prevailed on one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin, do you know if under the current Rule 82 for I distinguish regular civil litigants from public interest litigants,
mm-hmm,
because they're treated differently now.
Mm-hmm.
Are regular civil litigants under Rule 82, are they, is there a requirement to apportion attorney's fees by issue with them, or is that just left to the judge's discretion, do you know?
I believe it's left to the judge's discretion.
Senator Parnell. Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Also, in version I, costs, that doesn't address the issue of costs as it does in version K. So we can move down now to version K. That version is a free substitute that you also have before you. That amends Rule 79 and Rule 82. Rule 82 deals with the attorney's fees, and Rule 79 deals with costs. Under version K, a prevailing public interest litigant would receive 50% of attorney's fees for the case that goes to trial and 25% of attorney's fees for the case that goes to trial, which is a little more than civil litigants. A losing public interest litigant under this version, the court may award attorney's fees against a losing public interest litigant if the court finds that an issue is frivolous. And when we're talking about issues, This version allows the courts to apportion attorney's fees by issue. So for prevailing public interest litigants, as well as if you lose and an issue is frivolous, then you will be required to pay the prevailing party. Another difference in the version K is version K touches on costs, which hadn't been done before in the original version of the bill or the prior committee substitute. A prevailing public interest litigant would be awarded costs apportioned by issue, and a losing public interest litigant would pay costs for frivolous issues only, then treated in the same way as attorney's fees under that version. The version M, which is the compromise version, if you'll allow me to call it that, has not yet been distributed, but that version amends only Rule 82 in the court rules. Under this version, a prevailing public interest litigant would receive attorney's fees in the same manner as civil litigants under Rule 82, which is 30% if it goes to trial, 20% if it doesn't, and the fees shall be apportioned by issue. A losing public interest litigant would not have to pay attorney's fees to a prevailing party unless the court finds that the issue is frivolous. So there's a little bit of cushion there for the public interest litigant. Exceptions under Rule 82B3 would apply, and so the court may vary attorney's fees above the 30%, 20% limit for exceptional circumstances. The courts would be required to apportion by issue unless the courts can find exceptional circumstances, so there is a way for the courts to not apportion if they deem it necessary. And it doesn't address the issue of cost under this version, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, the version M has not been distributed?
No. No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We may want to distribute that before we get going too far. Now, realizing we don't have a motion for any of these before us, we'll just open the latitude of the committee to discuss any and all of these. And then when we get worked through this, we'll come back to a motion on whatever one we want to adopt and start our amendments from there. Senator Kelly and then Senator Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, in the compromised version M, though I haven't seen it, I'm reading from the fact sheet, where it says that the losing PIL, the court may award attorney's fee against the PIL only if issues presented were frivolous. Do we want to do that? I guess what I've seen, how much latitude is in the courts to determine what is frivolous and what is not? We've seen judges in this state who've been very active in creating laws, and I think something that they might agree with that would come forward to them that the whole state might agree was frivolous. I don't know that you could get them to say that it was frivolous. I think of one of our Supreme Court justices who's a former attorney for the Sierra Club. I don't know that I would ever agree or I would ever see him declaring the most absurd suit brought by an environmentalist group as being frivolous.
Well, I appreciate that. As we worked through this, it was one of my goals was to keep the true public interest litigant held harmless because I believe they do provide a role in a check and balances on some laws or some other things that may be out there. And it's very difficult. Just for the example you laid out, I'm trying to do that. So I can't disagree with you. How to say if a case is frivolous or not, we're just letting the courts, they currently have the power in Court Rule 11, I think it is, that gives them the power to kick things out and do it. It's just, in the public interest litigants, a doctrine that it's not even in statute, it's something the courts created. We didn't even create that. So. Looking at all of that, this is just an attempt to try to bring all this together. Senator Donnelly, I think, or Senator Parnell, you want to have a question?
Go ahead and sponsor, Mr. Chairman.
But did you have a question?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Wilkins and then Senator Parnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is answered by the packet. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Parnell.
Just in general, the direction I was coming from with version I was that public interest litigants, in my view, ought to be treated the same as civil litigants, in the sense that we shouldn't punish them for being public interest litigants by requiring more in attorney's fees from them. At the same time, that's what version I does. It tries to put them on the same level playing field as all civil litigants. Version K, Senator Kelly hit on one of those issues, and that had to do with the frivolous lawsuit. And version K at page 2, in awarding costs or attorney's fees, it has that language in there that says that if the court finds that an issue presented by a public interest litigant upon which litigant was not the prevailing party was not well-grounded in fact or not warranted by existing law or good faith argument, then the court may award attorney's fees, and it has the same language for costs. That language is not present, that I know of, in Rule 82 currently as it exists with respect to regular civil litigants. But what happens is during a court case, if a party thinks that the other party's arguments are frivolous and they're not well-grounded in fact, then you file what's called a Rule 11 motion and you ask for sanctions for filing frivolous claims. So this remedy already exists to public interest litigants and to civil litigants under Rule 11. And we start to mix the rules together here by moving it into the attorney's fees rule and then into the cost rule when it's already in Rule 11 as a potential sanction throughout the litigation. So I didn't see a need to include this kind of language in Rule 82 attorney's fees or in the Rule 79 language for costs. So that's why I thought this remedy already exists for civil litigants and public interest litigants as it stands now under Rule 11. There was no need to bring it up in this context, which is one of my objections to version K. But
Senator Adams, not being an attorney like my colleagues up here, is I'm still having a problem saying why do we need this piece of legislation? You know, this has gone through, you mentioned it went through the other body, House Bill number 176, and it failed on the floor. And the Supreme Court has ruled that public interest litigant is to be encouraged. And then people says, well, we have too much with frivolous lawsuits. But I don't think that's the case, because that we worked on these to stop those in our tort reform piece of legislation that we worked on 4 years ago. Because we can look at the Alaska rules of civil procedures to discourage frivolous lawsuits. And then you go back to the courts, and their criteria is so strong that it discourages them. And I'm just having a hard time reasoning why that we need this piece of legislation. Why would we want to stop or shortchange our residents, individuals, to question the action of the state in some cases by doing something like this? What also happens to this piece of legislation if you can't get the two-third vote for the court rule change on rule number 82? What happens to the piece of legislation? I just have Mr. Chairman, I'm having a very hard time trying to understand why we need this piece of legislation, because I think that we have sufficient rules, the Supreme Court, we have the our Alaska rules of civil procedures to stop frivolous lawsuits, and I'm having a hard time. I just hope maybe one of my colleagues that are attorneys can show me why we need this.
Thank you. Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, as Senator Parnell, I didn't have version K when you were reading from it. Where exactly was that piece that you were reading from?
On page, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Parnell,
on page 2, the change to Rule 79, which is the cost rule, which has to do with awarding costs after a case is over. Page 2 begins on line 6 and ends at line 10. That's the first reference. So when people say frivolous, that's the language they're referring to. And then at page 2, line 23 through 27, that's the same language as it applies to the attorney's fee rule, Rule 82.
So your objection was to version K.
And the same language is in version M as well.
And you're fond of version I.
Pardon me?
You would favor version I?
I favor version I. Right, because that's the level playing field between public interest litigants and the regular civil litigants.
Hey, I'm going to go to public testimony since we have a lull in questions, and we'll go through this and then bring it back toward the committee. Here in Juneau, we have Lori Muffins.
Huh?
Do we have anybody on telecom?
We have some on telecom. Come up and join us, Lord. Introduce yourself to the record. Senator Phillips, do you?
Well, I think out of courtesy, the ones off now should be taken here first versus the ones here in June. We can always talk to these guys here in June in the hallways or something. It's just a point.
Thank you. Lori, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Lori Huguenin. I'm the director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. In 1996, after the passage of the Domestic Violence Act, the court system, in trying to implement portions of that act, refused to allow people coming forward to apply for three separate protective orders, which had been granted in the Domestic Violence Act. The network met with the court system. We met with Mr. Snowden, who was the director at that time. We tried to meet with the forms committee of the court system to actually develop the forms that allows you to apply for protective orders. We asked for an attorney general's opinion about the specific reference and site in the DV Act to get a ruling on the problem language that they had in allowing people to apply for both an ex parte order and a regular protective order. We did everything that we could to try to resolve the matter without litigation and were unsuccessful. And so the network entered as a public interest litigant into litigation against the court system administration to compel them to comply with the statute to provide three separate protective order opportunities for victims who needed that. We were successful in the litigation. We had an attorney who worked with us to reduce costs and to reduce fees. We did a lot of the research ourselves in order to reduce costs and to reduce fees, and did everything that we could to try to settle outside of that litigation. But the court system administration just was not willing to reach any kind of accommodation. So when we won the litigation and the court system administration was forced to allow victims to come forward and file for protective orders separately, we were awarded attorney's fees. We didn't get all of them. Our total cost was around $24,000. We got about 19 that we recovered. And we had to do fundraising to make up that $5,000 difference. The network as an organization does not receive any state funds. We receive membership funds and we receive some federal grants. We're not able to use federal grants to enter into litigation. We don't think that's appropriate to do. So we were having t-shirt sales, sweatshirt sales, you know, doing things that we could do to raise money to make up that difference. And from testimony in the House, when another bill was being heard that has the same concept, we heard that public interest litigants were bringing millions of dollars worth of lawsuits, and that was sort of some of the problem, was it was costing the state a lot of money. And I would just urge the committee to consider the fact that sometimes there are small entities that need to bring forward valuable arguments to the state to be able to have citizens be able to exercise the rights that the legislature has enacted. We can't afford to bring forward that kind of legislation if we would have to pay more of the cost. So I would really urge your consideration for that. And I guess the one difference I see between public interest litigants and non-public interest litigants, which I guess would be the version I drafted the bill, is that non-public interest litigants are usually a difference between two individuals. It's not a difference between the state, whether it's the executive branch or the court or the judicial branch or the legislative branch, with all the resources that they have available to them against a group of citizens who aren't being able to exercise their rights. And I think if that kind of situation occurs and somebody is able to come forward as a public interest litigant, then I think if they are successful in prevailing, they should be able to return to recover their attorney fees and their costs. So that was what I wanted to let the committee know.
Thank you. Senator Jane?
Yeah, Lori, help me understand how
one group differs from another group in that no one in your group or collectively, you feel like you could hire an attorney and do what other people do to find their way through court. And even though the issues may be very tender and it's very difficult for us to sit here and say, well, we don't think that's a good idea, for you to hold yourself at a different level or standard when everyone else in the world comes forward when they do litigation and says, this is going to cost me money, time, effort, and a whole lot of trouble, and my chances of winning and losing are 50-50. So it's very difficult to argue with you when you have an issue that's so politically sensitive. But by the same token, why do we not hold everyone in the nation up to that same, or lower them to that same standard, so they never have to be responsible for any litigation they go forward with? Help me understand it.
Senator Ferguson, Senator Green. I guess I would reference my last comment. I think the difference in being a public interest litigant, whether or not it's domestic violence or sexual assault or maybe it's the environment or whatever issue it would be, the difference between that and two citizens who have a disagreement going into court is that we would bring forward an issue that one of the branches of government were not fulfilling their responsibilities to the citizenry. And I think that's the difference. I think it serves the public good to have the issue discussed in the forum of the court if all other attempts have failed, and that the public benefits from that discussion and should cover those attorney fees or costs.
Thank you for your testimony. We will go to teleconference per Senator Phillips' request. Bob Dickinson in, I don't know where you're at, I think in Anchorage.
Yes, this is Bob Dixon calling. I am in Anchorage. I'm a lawyer. I'm a shareholder in the law firm of Atkinson, Conway & Gagnon. I've been in private civil practice for about 27 years, a little more. My practice is commercial civil litigation, a lot of it in construction, some of it in health law. And I would like to talk in favor of what I understand now is to be version I, because it fundamentally treats all PIL, public interest litigants, the same as all other civil litigants. And I'll explain why as I walk through some of the comments. First, I'd like to correct, with all due respect to Darwin, the question was, in all other civil litigants, is the court able to apportion the issues? And the answer was, it's up to the court's discretion. Actually, what the Alaska Supreme Court has held, and this is a ruling of long standing, and it continues to hold to it, is that the lower court has the discretion to determine who is the prevailing party. The lower court is supposed to look at all of the issues, determine which are the core issues, the ones that were really litigated, and determine who prevailed on those. The case that has really prompted this, in which the court allowed the lower court to look at some issues and award attorney's fees even though there was a loss on a lot of other issues, is not so much saying that the lower court has the discretion to divide up issues, but it has the discretion to determine who is the overall prevailing party when all of the issues that are litigated are looked at. So that's really what the state of the law is right now. And I would suggest that it is very difficult. Some of these versions have the language that allows the award of attorney's fees or the decision to not award attorney's fees on an issue-by-issue basis. As a practicing lawyer, I can tell you that it'll be very difficult to carry out, not only among the lawyers who will be submitting motions, but more importantly, perhaps, the judges trying to figure out how much attorney's fees are attributable to what issue. That will be a very, very difficult thing to carry out. Another point is the question on, I think it was mentioned in version K, which will allow attorney's fees to be awarded only against a PIL, only when they're frivolous lawsuits. The law has been longstanding since back in the 70s, the law on attorney's fees, Rule 82, and it's not in Rule 82, but it has been a longstanding principle of the court, and that is, even though Rule 82 has always been designed to award partial attorney's fees, the court has always said, if a lawsuit is frivolous, or one of the parties has engaged in what they call vexatious conduct, if it's frivolous, the lower court has always had the ability to award full attorney's fees against the losing party if it was a frivolous lawsuit. And after 27 years, I can tell you there have been quite a few that I have considered frivolous, have prevailed on, and the courts have disagreed. I can tell you from my experience, and there's not a shadow of doubt, that the courts will not throw out cases because they are frivolous. It just as a practical matter, when you get a lawyer and a party who genuinely believe in their case, even if they lose, getting a court to say that it was frivolous is essentially impractical. It's just simply not going to happen. So as a practical matter, I don't see that as having any real effect. To the senator, and I didn't catch the name, and I apologize, but the senator had the question about why do we need this litigation, because tort reform addressed all of this and fixed it last year. Senator, the kinds of litigation that the PIL, this statute addresses, the litigation involving public interest litigants, has nothing to do with torts. The torts are when someone does something or allegedly does something wrong, is negligent. And the tort reform addressed those kinds of cases. If there is a tort claim, there automatically is enough money involved to provide the economic incentive to bring the lawsuit or defend the lawsuit. So it they're mutually exclusive between a tort case and the kinds of cases that the PLI people are involved in. Those are cases where a timbering is opposed or mining, or someone is attacking a zoning ordinance, or someone's attacking an election a result or a bond issue. Those are the kinds of issues that this legislation is looking at, and completely separate from the tort reform types. I think that one thing I have not heard in any of the debate, that one of the points I'd like to make is that, and I don't think it's really come home, is that the public interest litigation, which is an exception, as I heard, is an exception to Rule 82. It's not codified anywhere. It's not set out in any statute or even in Rule 82. Basically, what's going on is that the Alaska Supreme Court is making what are, in essence, political decisions of a nature that really ought to be made by the legislature. If you look at the over 100 cases since 1968 when this doctrine was started, what you find is that those parties who have been accorded public interest litigant status are those who are living a subsistence lifestyle. Newspapers, even the ADN was accorded that, even though it has a commercial operation. Environmental protection and conservation groups have always been accorded that status. Native cultural interests have. Homeowners who are opposing an apartment house going up a few doors away. Sometimes commercial fishermen, when they are, in essence, wanting to preserve the resources, but not if they're attacking regulations on set netting. Oil companies, miners, logging companies, trucking companies, labor unions, and others have always been consistently refused that status because the Supreme Court says that those parties have sufficient economic interest in the result of litigation they don't need to be accorded a PIL status. And the Supreme Court, as I think I've heard, the whole idea behind this, the court has explained the purpose for this exception as being to encourage plaintiffs to bring issues of public interest to the courts. That's what it said in the McCabe case, which started the whole idea of awarding full attorney's fees to a party that prevails. It also said in another case that litigation on behalf of the public interest should be encouraged. Few aggrieved parties would be in a position to advance the public interest by invoking the injunctive powers of the courts. And there are several other examples. Basically, the Supreme Court wants to encourage those types of public issues that have gone through the executive branch and have been found to be in accordance with the laws passed by the legislature. The Supreme Court wants those issues to be brought to the courts so that the Supreme Court can have its view of whatever the issue is. and it's basically a matter of separation of powers as to who should be making the political decision as to which groups are going to be preferred over others. And that's not a point or an argument that I've heard voiced, but it is, when you take a look at all of those 100 cases, you see a very definite pattern of those groups and interests that are considered politically correct or politically influential, such as newspapers and others, they receive this interest, whereas those interests that are aligned with more development and things of that nature are typically the on the other end of the decision. And that, I submit, is basically being a political decision ought to be made by the legislature. And that's why I suggest that the best way to do this is version I, which basically and simply says that all PIL litigants are treated like all other civil litigants. Alaska is the only state in the union that permits the recovery of even portion of attorney's fees as a matter of course in all civil cases. We're the only state that does it, and I can tell you, as a practicing lawyer, that that Rule 82, in its normal application, does have the effect of keeping really frivolous suits out and awarding those people who have prevailed, giving them an incentive because they will be able to recover a portion of their attorney's fees. Rule 82 already does the job of screening out, to the extent that it can effectively be done, the so-called frivolous cases. And it seems to me that since all other civil litigants in the state have to abide by Rule 82 in its normal application, that all other parties ought to be treated equally and without trying to give a boost or a detriment to one political group or another. Those are my remarks.
Hey, thank you. Senator Adams and then Senator Phelps.
I just have three questions, Mr. Dickinson, and thank you for your response. The first question is I'll just read them, is what is the purpose of applying Civil Rule 82 to public interest litigants? My second one is again, on frivolous lawsuits. I thought we have Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure to help stop that, and I thought that when the Supreme Court looked at this, that they made this criteria so tight that you would keep out frivolous lawsuits. And my last question is no matter what version that we look at on this, the passage of this amendment, doesn't it stifle the right of individuals or Alaska organizations to question the actions of the state, and it upsets our check and balance system that we presently have?
Let me start with the second question, because I didn't hear the first one, but the second one dealing with the frivolous. Rule 11 is a part of the Rules of Civil Procedure. It says, it talks to the lawyer. It says that any lawyer who signs a pleading has to basically, it does by signing it, certify that they have made some inquiry, reasonable inquiry into the facts, and the arguments that are being made are reasonably based upon the facts and are in accordance with the law, unless there is a good reason to be trying to change the law and you're upfront about trying to change the law. That is Rule 11. That I have never seen a lawsuit thrown out. In fact, I've never seen, there was one exception. I've never seen that rule used as a real sanction. In federal court, where there's a similar rule, I've seen it used once. But the Alaska Supreme Court, in interpreting Rule 82, has put in this other provision that full attorney's fees can be awarded against the losing party if the case was frivolous. But as my point being, that's what the Supreme Court says. That's what the law is. It simply has not stopped what some people consider frivolous lawsuits. The Supreme Court doesn't consider them frivolous. The second question, or the third question, was doesn't any version stifle the ability of people to question the action of the state? What it would do is it deprives an incentive for people to give them a financial incentive to do it. It puts everybody on an equal plane with all other people who have wrongs or interests that they want to protect. It doesn't put them at a disadvantage. It simply removes a very strong financial incentive. They can't lose. If they qualify, even if they lose, they don't owe any attorney's fees, and if they win, their attorney recovers full attorney's fees. So it does remove an incentive that, in the minds of many, has been abused. And I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first question.
My first question is, why are we applying Civil Rule 82 to public interest litigants? Why is that necessary?
Because that's a good question. The Supreme Court awards fees and costs by virtue of a statute that the legislature has enacted. That's 0960.10. That statute, the legislature says the Supreme Court is authorized to determine costs and allow costs, which include attorney's fees, to the prevailing party in a civil action. Therefore, all PIL litigation is considered civil litigation. So Rule 82 automatically covers PIL litigation. What this legislation is designed to do is remove an exception to Rule 82 that the Supreme Court, in its opinions, has carved out. So Rule 82 automatically applies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Dixon.
Thank you, Senator Allen. Senator Phillips.
Mr. Dixon, mine is more of a comment than a question. Your point about the Supreme Court making political decisions, that's been, I know you don't have the advantage of being here, but that has been brought up many times by a few of the members around this table, so I just want to let you know that.
Thank you.
Other questions of this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Dixon, for coming down today and listening in and for your
Thank
testimony.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
We have one more here in Juneau. Actually, didn't mark it. Pam Lowe, do you want to testify?
Yes,
okay. Join us at the table. Introduce yourself to the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Pam LeBeau, and I am president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And we do have a position on this legislation. Where some groups routinely challenge state research development decisions and are granted public interest litigant status, something that we as an organization, even though we're a nonprofit 501c6, we are never able to get that status. In fact, we have three cases that we are challenging right now, and we've garnered the funds to do that by soliciting our members for their donations, their contributions, so we can afford to do any lawsuits, any litigation, usually in defense of something that's happened. And our contributions come in the $25 to $1,000 range, depending on what people can afford. And we feel that our cases are to benefit public policy, such as defending the courts, the legislature's tort reform bill that was passed 2 years ago and is now being challenged as unconstitutional. We're involved in that case to the tune of a lot of money. We also think that these challenges, where they typically the anti-development, anti-business cases that are brought forth, there'll be numerous elements to the case, and where they may only prevail on one or two, possibly, if they prevail at all, then they're granted their full fee. So our position is that we would like to see the court, the law say that the court must apportion the same percentage of costs and fees paid to a public interest litigant as the percentage of issues raised on which the litigant prevails.
Thank you. I think members were handed a resolution by the state chamber. Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. This brings, that concludes our public testimony. Senator Parnell.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move version I. That's the version that takes it to, that would take public interest litigants to the same place as the regular civil litigant, and would move that as our working vehicle.
Yeah, there's a motion for the committee to adopt version I as the working draft. Is there objection? Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, I kind of like your version M. I know they're close. I guess we can start with it.
here.
I guess it's fine to start with version I, Mr. Chairman, because we can just then debate subsection G and version M and we'll replace section 2 of the bill or I with section 2 of M, I guess.
Is there objection to adopting version I? Hearing none, version I, LUC updated 119.00 will be the working document before us. Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, the draft version M, I think, has a reasonable compromise provision in section 2. Provide that a court in exceptional circumstances could still provide public interest litigants with larger than Rule 82 awards. And, but it does also include something that I think has been very importantly and is seriously lacking with the current court, and that's this issue of apportionment by issue. And it does also specifically say that if the litigation was found to be frivolous, the court should take appropriate action. And I know we've had testimony that the court never does this, but I think it's still meritorious to put it in this statute because it gives direction. And it also, frankly, prevents the court from in the future saying, making a decision they're never going to do this. Because I think it's good to have that there as a deterrent to frivolous litigation. And I don't trust this court at all to say that, to not say that it would simply never do that if it wasn't there. So I think it does serve a public purpose, a good public policy purpose, to have it included, that language actually included, that you've included in your version M. So if you want that in the form of a motion so we can debate it, Mr. Chairman, I'd move to substitute Section 2 of Version M for Section 2 of Version I.
I'll object. Okay. Is this our first amendment? Okay. This will be labeled Amendment Number 1, which would be to delete version or Section 2 of Version I and insert Section 2 Version M. There is objection. Senator Parnell, do you wish to?
Sure, I'm going to object just because there are at least two issues here. One is whether we want to allow the court to apportion the fees by issue. The public testimony, and my personal experience, is that that would be very difficult and confusing for the court to do. For instance, when a lawyer works a case, and let's say one party has what are called 10 causes of action. Make it simple, 5 causes of action. That means they've got 5 different claims against the other party. What this would do is say that the court should figure out how much attorney's fees were attributable to each of those issues, when in fact work is spread across those issues and is relevant to more than one issue at times. And instead, the current system is, as I believe his name is Mr. Dixon said, that the court just simply determines who the prevailing party is and then awards a percentage of attorney's fees for the time and trouble and effort that prevailing party had to go through to litigate their rights. So because trying to apportion fees by issue is not, would be complex and confusing in this area and any other area, I would be opposed to that part of it. Also, the second part of the amendment would require that if the court finds an issue presented by a public interest litigant to be frivolous, the court shall award attorney's fees. As has already been stated, sanctions can already be levied under Rule 11 for frivolous claims and any pleadings that have been signed. We've already been told that that is rarely used, if at all, in state court. I've never seen it in state court myself. I've seen sanctions in federal court under Rule 11. Mr. Dixon testify that the court already has the discretion to to award enhanced attorney's fees under Rule 82 for other equitable factors, meaning that if the court finds that the public interest litigants litigated in an over, not an overbearing way, but in a frivolous way or in a basically a pound them with paper kind of way, using the judicial system, if they abuse the judicial system, that could be one of those other equitable factors that the court can use already under Rule 82 to enhance the attorney's fees that are required there. I don't see a reason to build in a Rule 11 piece of language essentially into Rule 82. So I think the amendment has several failings, and I'd have to oppose it on those grounds.
Senator Wilkins, before I go, I want to comment on why we put that language in there on the frivolous part. Is that, A, they don't use it, and we want it. If we're using Rule 82 to be to redirect courts on how to apportion these fees or to set the fees, we wanted them also to have in front of them, in Rule 82, that they can not award them if it's frivolous. Now, I know that in Rule 11, they can go, but they have probably stated all through their rules are many different aspects that they could rule on, but we wanted this to be a part of Rule 82. And I understand it's repetitious to Rule 11, but I'm not sure that the judges go back and review Rule 11 that much, so that's why that was there.
Mr. Chairman, on that issue, at page 2, this is version M, where the language is coming from, at page 2, line 9, and the beginning of line 8, says, if the court finds an issue presented by a public interest litigant to be frivolous. So in other words, you have to, I had thought about trying to divide the question to vote once on whether the court could apportion fees by issue and then vote on whether they can award fees for bringing forward a frivolous issue. They're really linked, and so if you buy, you basically have to buy both here. You have to buy the fact that the court should apportion fees by issue if we're going to buy that the court should award sanctions by issue, should award attorney's fees by issue. So Rule 11 is the tool to be used here, but that's, I understand what you're saying.
The other question that I have is, do attorneys apportion any of their billing, or are you saying that they just basically walk into the court if you sue under not necessarily a public interest litigant, but some other thing, and if they don't prevail on it, does the court apportion that? Am I making sense?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay. Do they apportion any bill, any rulings, any attorney fees? Senator Donnelly.
Yes, and we have before us now several examples in the supplemental where the courts have apportioned the costs they've awarded for attorney fees. And that debate is a frequent one between the state and prevailing parties. You can see in the backup in the supplemental bill. Senator Parnell's right. It can get complex and difficult to do, but the courts do it.
But it would just be impossible for a law firm to break down their billing by issue if they knew they had to do it?
My answer is no. There are issues that Senator Parnell's correct. I mean, there is issues that will be overreaching for the entire lawsuit, but there are clearly other issues that are segregated, and you can and make an approximate assumption about what went into what. But that's what they argue about when they go to court and fight over whether it should be apportioned and how it should be apportioned. So it's not an absolutely clear-cut thing, but it is possible to make, reach some conclusions about it.
Thank you. Senator Wilkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three questions. First, Senator Donnelly or Parnell, did I hear you say that Rule 11 is available at any time from the beginning of a proceeding to the end? An attorney can bring that up in front of the judge at any time in regard to frivolous lawsuits?
Senator Parnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct. Under Rule 11, and you've got it in your packet under the Touch and Go Systems logo. It's basically what happens is if a pleading is signed or a claim is brought that's not well grounded in fact or warranted by existing law, or if there's no good faith argument for an extension, modification, or reversing of existing law, if something's imposed for an improper purpose under Rule 11. What an attorney does is he files a Rule 11 motion. It's basically a motion for Rule 11 sanction, and that's available at any time after you file the complaint onwards.
Yeah, thank you. Second question, looking at the two pages SB 123 differences, under the version I and version M, this paragraph prevailing PIL, do I understand under version I that for non-monetary judgments, the prevailing PIL will receive 30%, no more, no less? And under M, there's some other manner of calculation. Could I receive more than 30%?
Yes. Senator Parnell.
Yes. Under version I, a public interest litigant could receive more than 30%, as I understand it, because every other civil litigant could receive more than 30%. But if you look at Rule 82, it's only available, enhanced attorney fees, and I'm talking enhanced above 30%, are only available if the parties prove certain factors. They basically argue before the judge, we're entitled to more than 30% because, and then if you look at the factors that the judge considers under Rule 82, that's available to civil litigants, regular civil litigants, and public interest litigants.
Then what's the difference between prevailing PIL and version I and version M? Do those two say the same thing? I'm going to ask a question about apportionment here in a moment. So if we set apportionment,
in relation to the fees, they do say the same thing. But it can be apportioned.
My third question had to do with apportion. And under version M, the amendment shall be apportioned. Under version I, the maybe, is that the difference between version I and version M as far as apportion?
No requirement.
Senator Wilkins, I don't read an apportion in version I.
No requirement, under apportionment, no requirement to apportion. So is that is that then an option on behalf of the judge?
I'll let the attorney. Senator Don,
I think that's an accurate statement because version I implies apportionment is available because it's available in an existing Rule 82, the same as way it's currently available. It doesn't specifically address it, but since it's available in an existing Rule 82, and this just incorporates then the public interest litigants under that, it's available, it's just not required, where version M actually requires the apportionment by issue.
Can
we have Mr. Dixon comment on it if he's still here? He sounds like he's got more experience in that area than any.
Mr. Dixon, are you still with us?
He's online.
Why don't we call him?
Could I go back to question two?
Question two?
My question two, the difference between prevailing PIL and version I and version M. Do those both say the same thing if the attorneys can argue for higher than greater percent? Do not those two sentences say the same thing?
Senator Parnell.
Mr. Chairman, I, without taking a moment to look at that, since we just got version M, I can't say it at this moment.
Thank you.
Other questions? Let's take a short of these. We're trying to hook up Mr. Dixon again to answer that question. We've had ease while we reconnected with Mr. Dixon in Anchorage, so... Mr. Dixon, we did have a couple questions for you, if you don't mind. Senator Parnell.
Mr. Dixon, one thing came up, your discussion about when the court awards Rule 82 attorney's fees. You discussed how the court determines who the prevailing party is, and then they go into that 30% calculation and with the possibility of enhanced attorney's fees. I thought you said that they do not currently apportion fees by issue. I'm not clear on that. Could you clarify that for us?
Yes, that is correct. The Supreme Court has discouraged awarding attorney's fees by issue. The language in that most recent case was as far as they come, but typically the lower courts have been instructed on numerous occasions to look at all of the issues, to decide which were the ones that were primarily litigated, which ones were the core or central points of litigation, and the person who prevailed on that, the party who prevailed on that issue or those core issues, is determined to be the prevailing party and then recovers 30% if it goes to trial of all attorney's fees, even if some of those attorney's fees were spent on unsuccessful motions for summary judgment or or discovery issues that turned up to be not well taken, that type of thing. So the goal has been to decide, after the dust has settled at the end of the litigation, who, quote, prevailed, close quote. Now, it is up to the trial court. It's within the trial court's discretion to determine who has prevailed. And there have been a number of occasions where the lower court has decided neither party prevailed and then did not award any attorney's fees in either direction. But it is something, who prevails is up to the, within the discretion of the trial court.
Mr. Dixon, we currently have some discussion around our table because it appears from some of our state judgments that attorney's fees have been awarded based upon, you know, prevailing on a particular issue and have been segregated. Do you have any experience or knowledge of those as opposed to the prevailing party determination?
No. In fact, my experience and my understanding of the Supreme Court is that what the trial courts are supposed to do is determine who prevailed overall and not on a case by case or an issue by issue basis. And the problem with that is the Supreme Court has recognized is how do you determine how much attorney's fees were spent on which issue. Typically, all issues move forward at the same time. Some are subject to a summary judgment issue, some are not, and it's very difficult to separate out fees that are attributable to a definitive claim or point.
Senator Donnelly.
I have a way out of this box, Mr. Chairman. The real public policy problem I think we all want to address on the apportionment issue is currently, we've got some professional litigators out there, you know, some certain public or special interest groups that have staff attorneys that they probably pay $30 or $40 an hour who go out and file lawsuits and then get judgments, even if, and file a lawsuit and they plead maybe 20 items. They may prevail on one item, but then they get an award of attorney's fees based on 20 items. And thus they make a lot of money, plus the court awards the fees based on $150 an hour rather than what they're actually getting paid for their salaries. They take that money back and file more lawsuits. So it actually is encouraging litigation, and it actually encourages almost frivolous litigation to argue and plead as many issues as you can, even though you know you're not going to win on them. As long as you win on one, you get paid for all of them. And I think that's a real serious problem that I'm hoping this legislation will address. And maybe the way to do that is to compromise here and say that the apportionment only occurs if the court awards more than the standard Rule 82. No. The court makes the decision, okay, we're going to give more money to this public interest litigant than the standard Rule 82. Then we compel them to apportion and only award for the actual things they prevailed on. What do you think of that?
Would that be above the 30%, you mean?
Yeah, if they go above the 30%, then they are required to apportion.
So it wouldn't be true Rule 82, because Rule 82 lets them exceed the 30%.
Right.
Mr. Dixon, do you have a comment on that?
That's an interesting comment, or an interesting concept. I suppose in the last analysis, that would be a reasonable compromise. It is true that Rule 82 permits a trial court to go beyond the 30% or 20%, there are about six different factors. And I should point out one of those factors is the extent to which a given fee award may be so onerous to the non-prevailing party that it would deter similarly situated litigants from the voluntary use of the courts. The whole issue of keeping poor people out of the courts has been an issue that has rightfully so troubled the Supreme Court with Rule 82. And so this most recent amendment to Rule 82 has put that provision in as a way around the typical application. So if the committee were to say Rule 82 applies to everybody, including PIL, that part would go with that and would still give the lower court the opportunity to prevent a losing public interest litigant from being hit with a lot of attorney's fees if the in the discretion of the trial court had thought it was warranted. But getting back to the other question, if they're going to award more, the other side of the coin, if they're going to award more, requiring them to go to a issue-by-issue basis is certainly better than the current situation. That's clear. I've raised the point of the difficulty in apportioning it, but putting that difficulty aside, requiring that if they're going to go above the 25 or 20 or 30% would be better than the current situation.
Senator Parnell.
On the idea, I guess it comes back to the fundamental issue of why would we treat public interest litigants different than civil litigants in that regard? For instance, a civil litigant could file and may file eight causes of action in a complaint. They may have eight different claims in a complaint, one or two of which are very strong, the other six of which they've got a 10% chance of winning or a 5% chance of winning on. And yet what we're saying is, That's occurring currently in the civil litigant context, but we're saying in the public interest litigant context that we're going to punish you for doing that, too. When they have a colorable argument, they've not been sanctioned for raising those claims, even if they have a 5% chance of winning. So the fundamental issue is, why would we treat them different than the civil litigant in that context? I don't know why we would do that.
Senator Donnelly.
And maybe we don't treat them differently. Maybe we make it apply to everybody under Rule 82, that if they go beyond that, then they should apportion based on which issues they did prevail on. But there is a good public policy argument for also making it for public interest litigants, and that's that the court uses the public interest litigant label to abuse the process and to award excessive fees. We've seen that. They've proven their propensity for abusing the process by over-awarding fees to people they classify as public interest litigants, even when they're not truly prevailing parties. So we're addressing a specific abuse the court's been doing, and they use that label to as an excuse for that abuse they're doing. But I think it would be appropriate. It might be fine to apply it to everybody.
Senator Phil.
Can I ask Mr. Dixon for a recommendation?
Mr. Dixon?
Yes.
Senator Phillips asked if you had any recommendations on the debate that we just had, on whether or not...
My feeling would be to, if something's not broken, don't fix it. So I'm a little hesitant to suggest making this new wrinkle about going beyond the 20 or 30% apply to all civil litigants. I haven't really thought that out. I can tell you that for a long period of time, there was a lot of litigation just over Rule 82. You'd have basically two chapters of the lawsuit, first on the merits and then second on the attorney's fee issue. The Supreme Court basically said it's mostly up to the discretion of the trial court trying to reduce that. So I'm concerned that if, to the extent we tweak it more, we run the risk of more litigation over just what that means in the run-of-the-mill civil litigation, the commercial stuff, the tort stuff, the other type of things. So I'm a little hesitant I would recommend not going that way because I'm concerned about how it would affect all the rest of the bread and butter type cases that go before the courts and the citizens and the companies that have to use the courts. I think effectively is simply to try to treat the PIL litigants the same as all others. I mean, I think as a practical matter, in looking at the way it would practically work itself out in the day-to-day business of the courts, is that the only effective change would be to basically treat everybody the same.
Thank you. Senator Parnell.
We have before us an amendment. Senator Donnelly moved an amendment that would add language from version M, page 2, which was subsection G, that would require the court to apportion the fees by issue. And it says if the court finds an issue presented by a public interest litigant to be frivolous, then the court shall award attorney's fees under B of this rule. So essentially this provision as it sits right now is more punitive to public interest litigants than to civil litigants because it's requiring the court to apportion the fees by issue, which we're not requiring of non-public interest litigants. Maybe the thing to do would be to vote on this particular amendment, and if Senator Donnelly has another amendment to deal with the issues he's raised, then we could take those up. Instead of working to craft this one, just a suggestion.
Thank you. Senator Adams.
The
compromise language that I thought that Senator Donnelly had expounded on. I thought it was very good, that you would be paid for only the causes, the good causes that you would win. You would not be paid for the ones that were frivolous causes. And I was hoping that was the direction we were coming to at this particular point.
Senator Parnell?
Well, on that, that's a good point, except it's confusing and complex to try to apportion by issue. And that's why they only get 30% of their attorney's fees. I presume that's one of the reasons they get 30% of the attorney's fees, is because you bring eight causes of action, all of which have some merit, but two of which you've got a 90% shot of winning on, six of which you've got a 5% chance of winning on. If you actually are determined to be the prevailing party, you're only entitled to 30% of your attorney's fees if you go through trial, and with the possibility of enhanced attorney's fees. So I guess what I'm saying is that the 30% is recognition that some of the claims are going to fall by the wayside, but it's also causing people to think about filing a lawsuit and take a second look at it, because it could cost them that. It could cost them money to the other party if they don't prevail. So it really is a hard thing to start saying we're going to apportion fees by issue. It just adds more work to the courts and adds more litigation for the Supreme Court to resolve.
Senator Don?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought it was important to have the work that you had done with other members of the legislature before the committee, and that's what this amendment is. I don't know how this is a really important discussion, and I think we're all learning a lot. I don't know how you feel about it, but I kind of like the idea of because I want to go ahead and finish out on this amendment if you would like it, because you helped develop this language. But if not, I could withdraw that amendment and propose something else. It'd take me some time to get it drafted up. But what I would think I would like to go, the direction I would suggest possibly we consider, is that if the court awards in excess, and make it apply to all litigants, not just the public interest litigants, but if the court awards in excess of the Rule 82 standard amount, then it shall apportion based on issue, unless it finds exceptional circumstances, the language that you've come up with already here, that require an award of fees without apportionment, and also maybe something that requires the court to state in their decision why they found those exceptional circumstances, articulate why. And that gives the court a way out, so if they find it's too hard to apportion, they don't have to, but it gives them direction that they should apportion if they're going to award more than the standard Rule 82.
Senator Green?
Just review for me, I think I may have missed the discussion earlier, on the 30% attorney's fees, are these actual costs, as you had referred earlier, to the normally work for $30 an hour, that much? Or is this the inflated thing that we've seen in finance when we've, the 195 or the 295 or whatever fee that we're doing 30% of? Because that makes a big difference. Because otherwise, we're paying 300% plus or 1,000% of their fees. And you can put anything in here you want to, unless you're requiring a billable, their normal attorney's fees. I mean, like if you did attorney's fees, you would have a method by which it says X number of hours at this, and that's what I would assume you would present to the court. Are you telling me that they could, in a civil case, could they say, oh, we're not going to compute it at your normal $200 an hour fee, but we're going to take it to $350 an hour fee and do it? Well, how can they do that in public interest litigation then? Why is it?
It goes the other way.
Can I respond to that?
Senator Donnelly, and then we'll come to you, Mr. Dixon. Go ahead.
The answer to that is in all other civil litigation, it is the actual fees incurred, the actual checks written by the client, and then the first thing the court does is whether that's reasonable. And if it's been too much, the court chops that down to reasonable actual fees and awards 30% of that figure. The exception, part of the public interest litigation exception is that, and I think it was a Trustees of Alaska case, where it was demonstrated by the other party that they were only basically charged $40 or $50 an hour, but their point was, well, similar lawyers charge $150 to $200 an hour for that, and we should get the value of that, and the Supreme Court accepted that. So it's only in PIL litigation where this they've actually allowed greater than actual attorney's fees.
Is there some way we can address that issue? See, to me, that may be the bigger problem, whether how you compute it.
Certainly, that's possible. That's possible.
I think that's...
Senator Donnelly.
I think that's included in either version that's before us, is by requiring them to follow the rules, standard Rule 82 rules, they're not able to give that special, you know, award three times as much as it actually costs them. Attorney's fees award.
And so that's in, excuse me, where else is that found? In another section of law altogether?
It doesn't need to be found. It's just included in the concept that you make it the same for public interest litigants as for ordinary
litigants. Are you saying then that you could inflate anyone's fee schedule that they presented for their times their number of hours?
I suppose if the court subsequently, I wouldn't put past this court. I mean, they abuse the public interest so much, it's amazing. But I guess if a court, after passage of this law, subsequently ruled that, well, for all cases, we may just go ahead and award, you know, what the value of it is versus the actual cost, then I guess they could get around it and they could still hand out more than the actual cost, like they're currently doing with the public interest litigants. But they would have to do it for everybody and not just for them.
Senator Donnelly, if you want to remove the amendment, that would be fine. I think it sounds like we're compromise language there might be the way to go. It's my intent to do that, and then I do want to take some testimony on Senate Bill 6, so... we'll set this bill aside and give Senator Donnelly a chance to come forward with it.
Why don't I take that amendment off the table first?
Yes, that'd be fine.
So I'll move to withdraw amendment number one.
Okay. Motion to move amendment number one. Senator Adams.
If you can circulate the proposed compromise amendment in a day or two, we'd appreciate it for the rest of the committee.
We'll do that before we schedule the bill back up again. So. Senator Wilkins, do you have a comment? Okay, we are working under version I that was adopted, so that will be the version that we work with, and then we'll go from there with any amendments. So we will, good debate on that. We'll set that one aside, and we'll go to Senate Bill 6. Darwin, you want to join us real quick? Senator Taylor, you can join. I'm going to have Darwin walk us through the CS real quick, and then we have some folks for public testimony. This CS, we just got it late last night, so this is the committee hasn't had a chance to review this, and I'm positive that it's not out to the LIOs yet. So we won't be moving the bill today. We'll just get it started on what the CS does. Darwin, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Darwin Peterson, Finance Committee Aide, Senator John Ferguson. I've been asked by the chairman to just really quickly go through some of the more important changes that were made between the work draft version H, which is the version that has been adopted by the committee, and the new committee substitute, which is version M. First of all, everywhere where the state was required to dispose of land, the word offer was included in there, so it reads that the state shall offer for disposal. Also, the number of acreages to be offered is decreased from 250,000 acres to 100,000 acres. The creation of the land disposal advisory board was deleted, and that was replaced with public nominations that are sent to the state land commission. All of the sections in the bill that are repealed and reenacted, those are sections that would go back into effect June 30th, 2009, which is the sunset date of this new state land commission. All those sections were taken out. The sunset date was repealed. Also was taken out. Also. So this state land commission would go on in perpetuity. The the sections of the bill, for example, Section 7, Section 9, Section 11, all the sections where the powers of the commissioner were given to the commission to submit reports to the legislature to do analysis and assessment of the market demand, all of those were taken out, so the powers to do those specific things would still rest with the commissioner of the department. Those are the major changes, Mr. Chairman. The bill, Senate version M, is much smaller. It's only 5 pages, and mainly the reason is because all those repealed and reenacted sections were taken out, and commissioner sections were quite lengthy, and those were repealed. Those were taken out also.
Okay. Senator Adams and Senator Schultz.
Basically, as I was looking for a fiscal note on the new version of M, is that going to be forthcoming?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, that fiscal note hasn't even been requested yet.
Okay, has not been requested. Okay.
No, we just got this last night, so
okay.
I would expect that this will have about a $10 million fiscal note that will be attached to this. We currently have about 50,000 acres, my understanding, and Bob's online, they can verify, but 50,000 acres of land will be reoffered, would be included in this. So what we're suggesting here is that we would add another 50,000 acres to it, and then the fiscal note will reflect the cost of trying to get that through the zonings and map and so forth. And I told the committee last week that I would... They're going to change this to an appropriation bill, and so that we would it actually would go along with this instead of the fiscal note. We'd be voting on the appropriation when it came before the actual legislature. So the money and the upfront costs are going to be very well identified to the committee before we go forward with the bill. But at this point in time, since we haven't circulated the CS, it got here so late that we're not going to take any action on it today. Senator Adams.
One more question. This in Section 2 creates the Landfill Commission.
Yes, sir.
And then I go on further to Section number 10 as I read it. That how do we solve the disputes between a director, the commissioner, or the State Land Commission when we have problems on what land should be auctioned? You know, there's going to be a time when you have a dispute on between either the commissioner or director versus the Sale Land Commission. And there must be something in here on what procedures that we're going to follow, because one side might say this land is available and the commission says no, it isn't, or vice versa.
Well, Senator Adams, most of this is going to come out of the area plans, or the land's already classified. So after it's classified, if there's a debate between the land commission and the director, the land commission under this piece of legislation prevails. But we also set the nomination pieces in here, so the first, be my intent that whether the bill's written that way or not, that the first 50,000 acres that are added to this to make the 100 would be done by the department. And then from then on, it'd be by nominations of, like we do with oil, we used to do with oil and gas before we got an area-wide leasing. Somebody would nominate that they want some land for sale, and then we would add that to the land bank for actually for sale, so that we'd actually be putting land in that there was some interest out there for people to buy. So that's kind of how that's...
Okay, thank
now,
you.
Now, whether or not the bill says that, I know we have some work to do on this, but that's the intention. Okay. Senator Phelps.
If you turn to page 4, I just want to... What's the difference between the permanent fund eligibility and living in the state a year prior?
Senator Taylor?
I think we need to examine this, because I think there's probably some... Might be some potential problems in
the primary reason, Senator Phillips, through the chair, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for putting that in was that we received about 3 years ago a lot of public comment and concern because the Department of Natural Resources was advertising on the web about land that were available in Alaska, and that in the method and manner in which we had been selling properties, I could cite you to some specific experiences on an excursion inlet where groups of wealthy doctors down south were outbidding local people here in the Juneau area that had tried to get that land for years, and literally in one instance outbid them by like a few hundred dollars on about a $70,000 purchase. Because of that public reaction, I initiated legislation, which we did pass, into law, and that now provides that the land shall first be offered to Alaskans, and the way we did it was based on that same definition of residency and used the permanent fund dividend residency requirements so that first offer would go to Alaskans. They'd have a first right of refusal, so to speak. And if the property did not sell, it would then be advertised for the general public who may wish to purchase.
But, Senator Taylor, yeah, I understand that. I understand it. What I'm really questioning right now is the current law says the resident of the state for at least 1 year prior to the date of application, and then we're using a different criteria. I want to know what the differences are between it, because we went through this permanent fund dividend problem before. What do you do with the dependents of the military? Now, that's going to be a question that's going to come up with long-time Alaskans. So if we're using the permanent fund criteria, might be, and I want to know what the difference is between the permanent fund criteria and what we have on the books. Does that mean you have to be physically in the state for a year prior under the PFD criteria? That's, you know, that's not a requirement. So I want to explore that before we
certainly
go ahead.
I'll work with,
and that's
going to
be a thorny problem coming up. Am I wrong? Am I wrong on that?
No, you bring up a good point. I'm not sure what the difference in the eligibility requirement is. We'll try to have a side-by-side by the next meeting.
I'd be happy to.
It does bring up, and I understand where Senator Taylor's trying to go with this, give Alaskans first shot at it, but Alaskans had first shot before,
right,
if you were here for a year, but we'll have to put them side-by-side. Maybe we're saying the same thing. But
I want to make sure.
Yes, we'll have that.
I might just make a couple other comments, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Taylor,
I know our time is limited. In the first blush of this bill, as it was presented, we had included within it the requirement that the commissioner may require the purchaser of land to provide at the purchaser's expense, not the state's expense, the cost of appraisal and cost of survey of the land. And I believe that that would, if such a provision was placed back within the bill, and I know we've gone through a lot of changes since then, I think it would significantly diminish whatever fiscal note the department may place on it.
And we're going to explore that, Senator Taylor, but some of the problems we run into is the state, as the owner, is the only one that can bring action before local planning commissions. You and I cannot do that on behalf of the state without some kind of power of attorney, I don't know, whatever, some kind of legal document that gives that person the power. Now, that doesn't mean that we couldn't put some kind of stipulation in there to pay up front, but we're not going to get to 100,000 acres unless we, you know, if we're going to sell land, we're going to have to come up with the money.
Right.
And we're going to have to set up a good program to do that. I think once we get the money set up and get the land in the land bank, that this thing can be, can live on program receipts and some other pretty creative things to where we might be able to get to that. But it's kind of almost two issues up front, but I understand what you're saying. And okay, I want to go to public testimony real quick. We have a Mr. David Sneed in Wrangell.
I'm here.
Okay, you have some testimony, sir?
I'll keep it brief because I know you have other business. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I've been a resident of Alaska for 11 years and worked hard that entire time. I've tried to save money. I've done a lot of outdoor work in the middle of the winter, 10 below, 20 below. I've tried to save my money to buy land, and the price goes up faster than I can get the down payment together. The price is driven up by speculation, both public and private. I cite the example of the Haynesboro and the aforementioned Excursion Inlet land. The supposed mandate to reap the biggest public financial rewards out of the sale of land actually causes harm to a portion of the public that is trying to be good, productive citizens. This bill that I have is, I believe, version H, so it's somewhat different than what you're working on right now, but I'll try to make my comments apply. In your findings and intent section, I would recommend that you mention that it is important to encourage remote settlement for individual economic opportunity and for the other benefits accrued to the state simply by having residents located more evenly across the land. Here in Southeast, there's vast places where if a boat goes down or somebody gets in trouble, it'd really help to have somebody every 5 miles that's got a dock that can buzz out there and help them out. Because if it's not fishing season, there's a lot of space in between boats out there in the winter. I'd also like to see the legislature go on record with the bill that you respect the right and support the right of citizens to choose to live in remote areas in a condition less dependent upon publicly supplied services, because DNR will constantly tell you that they don't want to make land available for living in remote areas because they're afraid that people will demand too many services. Some of us need less services than others and can still be productive members of society and the state. On more practical matters, I would like to see that a restriction on what DNR can do with, they make too much land available for recreation and private residential. And there's plenty of that out there, and the price is very high, and it drives up the price and the tax base for those who want to simply live there to farm or to use it as base to fish from. Agriculture is a valid, I've been a farmer many years in some tough climates, and agriculture is a valid pursuit even in Southeast. In fact, we need agricultural land here because we have a moderate climate and we can grow for a lot longer than the rest of the state can, or the majority of the state. I'd like to see you consider parcel size down to 10 acres being available for agriculture because under certain technologies you can make a living off that amount. I am concerned about potential delays by DNR and you putting too much power into the commissioner himself to arrange this, because every evidence I've had, and I've done a lot of research on it, is that DNR is not currently inclined to make land available for remote home sites or for homesteading and agriculture. And this is included by reviewing any of the five-year plans that they have put out on any of the sections. One other concern I have is, can we restrict subsurface rights under agricultural land so it doesn't immediately present disruption if someone finds oil or minerals under somebody's land that everybody's put their heart and soul into? Is that land going to be disrupted for a sale as they tried to do in Homer with the oil leases? And there's plenty of mineral land out there, and maybe the stuff under agricultural base we can save for a mineral bank for another 50 or 100 years. I'm a little bit concerned about having two real estate members on the commission. I know that they know about land and pricing and things, but once again, I'm worried about our whole paradigm being set so that we're looking at it as a way to make money for the state rather than also getting people, citizens, into a place where they can be useful citizens to the state as a whole. And I hope that all meetings are mandated to be open meetings